I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It is every parent's greatest fear that after the birth of a child, a doctor will say, there's a problem. Dan and Barbara Kennedy got just such a scare 12 years ago this summer when the doctor told them there was something wrong with their new baby, Rebecca. Her head, he told them, was too large. Could be brain damage. It could be dwarfism. Dan Kennedy tells of his relief when they learned that there was no brain damage, but the eventual diagnosis of dwarfism was news that Dan Kennedy says he received with, well, ignorance. Dan's a journalist and quickly began learning all he could about achondroplasia and other kinds of dwarfism. It led to a book called Little People, Learning to See the World Through My Daughter's Eyes. So join us in this program. Why is it that most of society knows so little about dwarfism? Why is it that people still stare at dwarves and other people who simply look different? And what about you? Do you see dwarfism as simply a physical difference or a disability or a defect? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio today is Laura Zerpolo. Laura's a director with Blue Cross Blue Shield in Massachusetts. She's also been active for more than 30 years with Little People of America. It's an organization that advocates for those of short stature and their families. Laura, in fact, was the chairperson of the annual national conference last year. As I mentioned a little while ago, this year's conference begins in San Francisco tomorrow. Laura, you're not in San Francisco. It's good to have you here.
Thank you, Dick. It's great to be here.
Dan Kennedy's also here in the studio. He is the senior writer for the Boston Phoenix and contributor to numerous publications, including The New Republic, Slate, and Salon. As I mentioned, he has a new book. It's called Little People. Dan, it's good of you to come in.
Thanks for having me, Dick.
Now, we need to talk about Becky, who is not here, and someone that I was just chatting about. She's going to be 12 in August, is that right?
That's right. She just finished the fifth grade, had a great year. A few weeks ago, she was at Camp Little People, which is a program for about 50 or 60 kids with dwarfism, and Laura was one of the counselors.
How was she? Did she behave herself?
Oh, she was fabulous. We had a lot of fun doing crafts and just really engaging with the kids. Becky's got a lot of great energy. It's hard to keep up with her.
Camp Little People is something connected to Little People of America, is that right?
I think it's an independent program.
It is, but it's primarily focuses on individuals that are in the Pennsylvania area, and then we do outreach beyond that. We have about 100 slots, and it's a very contained program, and it's just fabulous. Beautiful piece of property, rolling hills, center of, you know, in Pennsylvania, and it's a wonderful place for the kids to be together with their friends that are within LPA and ride their bikes and just have a great time.
Okay, remind me. I want to come back to this, but before we get too far along, Dan, take me back, if you can, to that time 12 years ago when you began to discover all you have since come to learn about achondroplasia and another aspect of dwarfism. I said at the beginning of the program that you got the news with a certain degree of ignorance, and I said that in part speaking about myself as well, because I discovered reading your book just how little I knew.
Sure, and it's a very rare condition. There are only 30,000 to 50,000 people with dwarfism in the U.S., so many people can go their whole lives without actually meeting someone with dwarfism. What I like to explain is that we kind of learned, the revelation came to us in two stages. The first was initially when Becky was diagnosed with achondroplasia. We were given some literature on Little People of America by the geneticist, which I have since come to learn is not necessarily the standard practice, and you know, that geneticist deserves some credit for doing that. And we were given a very positive prognosis for Becky. And so for the first few months, we really kind of just tripped along trying to get used to this, trying to figure out what it was all about. I write in the book that I'd kind of walk along with my hand at chest level trying to figure out how tall Becky would be. The second and much ruder awakening came when Becky was 5 months old and landed in Mass General Hospital with a respiratory condition that would have been no more than a bad cold for most kids, but nearly killed her. We found out within a few days that she had a rare but not unheard of complication of dwarfism, in which her breathing passages were simply too small and would be until she could get older and bigger. She needed a tracheostomy. She needed oxygen for a couple of years. We had nurses running in and out of the house.
A tracheostomy for a couple of years?
A couple of years. 2 years. Oh. So she came home after 2 months in the hospital to oxygen, monitors, nurses. And I think at that point, my wife Barbara and I realized that what we didn't know about dwarfism could kill our daughter. And that's when our real education began.
It's interesting in a way because you're kind of self-deprecating. You say that Barbara, your wife, got this a little faster than you did. She was able to sort of not only look at some of the health aspects, but some of the social aspects with a little more insight than you.
Oh, absolutely. My powers of denial are remarkable, and they remain so to this day.
I think it's an interesting observation, though, Laura, when Dan brings us to the story of the health complications that Becky had, because when we talk about dwarfism, we think only in terms of the height. Dan talks about all the other sort of physical aspects you're better able to describe it than I am, but difficulties with the spine, difficulties with the bowed legs, that sort of thing. These are issues that are, I guess, of greater concern than how high somebody is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're exactly right. And I mean, the complications with the skeletal structure and the orthopedic concerns are far greater. And that, you know, through the life of a dwarf, I mean, 90% of dwarfs have some sort of orthopedic spine neurological surgery. And that's significant. I mean, 90%, I mean, 10% are unaffected. I mean, that's huge.
And we're talking about people with a number of different kinds of dwarfism as well, right?
Oh, yeah, we're talking about over hundreds.
Now, yeah. Becky has achondroplasia. Yours is different from that?
Mine is different. Mm-hmm. I have the second most common form, and it's called spondyloepiphyseal dysplasia congenita.
Is it okay if I don't try and ever say that on the radio?
Totally fine.
I'll fall all over myself.
Well, in the world of acronyms, we call it SED.
Right.
So in the LPA world or the LP world or little people world, we call it SED. And then we also, as Dan mentioned, his daughter has achondroplasia, we'll use the acronym ACON. So kind of within our culture, we have our own little terminology to help shorten the, you know, the complexities of the words because it's a mouthful.
I want you both to help me a little bit with the terminology here because I started reading Dan's book and first came across the term little people and thought to myself, well, that's a little pejorative. Why would dwarfs want to be called little people? And read on only to discover that the word midget has the same sort of connotations as the N-word, that mm-hmm. nobody uses that term. I didn't know that either. Is this something that you find that people just stumble with the very words to describe dwarves?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, the top three words that we, you know, hear are midget, dwarf, little person, and then I'll actually add a fourth one, is short statured. So you'll find that most people that are dwarfs and little people are very offended by the word midget because it has such a negative connotation, Dick. I mean, over the years, that word, it just, whenever it was used, it was always used in reference to someone that was entertainment, someone that, you know, may not have had significant value to society, and it just was a quick word, and when it's said, it almost has this visceral tone to it, and that's where the reaction comes from. So people in our culture prefer to, you know, be called either dwarf or a little person or short statured. So it's almost individual. You know, I tend to use all three words in a sentence when I'm talking because I've got to be politically correct with my, you know, with my friends. And we, in all intents and purposes, we know that some people are more sensitive to than others. I'm not. To those, you know, someone says little person, short statured, dwarf, I'm okay with it. But if someone says, hey, Laura, you're a midget. Whoa. I stop and I take a moment and say, you know what? That's not appropriate. Huh. And here's why. And it's not. And people really react to words, and it's just how it's all in context.
You had this same discovery, Dan.
Absolutely. And I must say, before Becky was born, Barbara and I would have thought that dwarf and midget were equally acceptable or unacceptable.
Yeah.
And that little person was probably the most acceptable. What I found was that little person is sort of the least common denominator within the community. It's the most broadly accepted. But I've also found that younger, more politically aware people aren't too crazy about it. They find it's too euphemistic, too cute sounding. Mm-hmm. And there's probably a preference for dwarf among younger people. Midget, interestingly enough, is a made-up word that only goes back to the 1860s. Now, there's kind of this urban legend that P.T. Barnum coined the word. In fact, in doing my research, I found that that was not the case. One of the meanings of the M word is someone whose proportions are the same as an average-sized person who was not a dwarf. Well, P.T. Barnum had the most famous proportionate dwarf in history working for him, Charles Stratton, better known as Tom Thumb. And yet, in Barnum's autobiography in the 1850s, he always refers to Charles Stratton as a dwarf, because the word midget had not even been coined at that point. It seems to have been first used to describe a person in a novel by Harriet Beecher Stowe, who, interestingly enough, was a neighbor of Barnum's and knew him. And later on, in the latter part of the 19th century, when Barnum was in his declining years and getting more into the circus, then he did start using the word because it was coming into general acceptance. And by the way, it only became pejorative fairly recently. The very first gathering of Little People of America in 1957 was put together by Billy Barty, the actor, and they gathered under the banner Midgets of America. So you see, in one generation, it's come to be seen as a very offensive term. So you really can't blame people if they use it unknowingly. Right. I mean, you just kind of educate them.
We talked earlier in the program, Laura, about the Little People camp that you're a part of, and I'm drawn to ask why it's useful, why it's important for those kids to have an opportunity to go for some kind of summer experience with other kids who are the same height. Is it to reinforce in their mind that they, you know, because they might be the only, you know, 10-year-old who's particularly short living on their street, that they're not alone in the state or in the country? What's that about?
Well, I can tell you it has a family focus. And kids need, when they come to the camp, they bring their parents or a guardian or someone in a supervisory role. So we have the approach, we want to make it the inclusive of everyone in the family, because that's an important part of the connection. And we want kids to be able to come and explore this camp with their friends that are dealing with the same issues that they're dealing with. And that they, for 3 days, can just break down the walls and they can have fun just being kids and not worry about people staring at them, making fun of them, saying things about the way they walk and how they may use mm-hmm. a wheelchair or a walker. It's a place where they can just be themselves and not have to worry about it. And if you could just see the kids running with the look in their face and being so energized to be with each other, it's fascinating. You know, they want to stay up at all hours of the night just because they love being with each other. And they can just be themselves and they don't have to worry about, you know, everything that's being, you know, all the pressure that's put on them when they go to school. And they, you know, they do fishing, they crafts, they do all the fun kid things, you know,
without this distraction of you know, can I sit in that chair, can I be a part of that group without standing out
exactly
from the other ones. Our telephone number, by the way, is 1-800-423-8255, and I think Laura's put her finger on something that many of us have experienced in some way, and that is, if you're a parent, you've been with a kid, you've been at a mall, you see a dwarf across the hall, and although the child might see someone in a wheelchair or somebody on crutches, in this case, they'll point, they'll stare, they'll say something rude, and you're, as a parent, you're going, oh, man, don't do this. And I think it's in many ways a part of trying to understand the gap that still exists between people of average height and dwarfs in society. We'd like to hear from you about your own experiences. We'd also like to have you as part of this conversation with Laura and Dan Kennedy. Once again, our number's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. The number to join our conversation, 1-800-423-TALK. With me in the studio, Laura Zerpolo. She's Director of Financial Services at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts, has been active with Little People of America now for more than 30 years. Dan Kennedy's also here. He's a senior writer for the Boston Phoenix newspaper, contributor to a number of other publications, but here today because of a book that he's written called Little People, Learning to See the World Through My Daughter's Eyes. That daughter, Becky, is going to be 12 in August. She is not with us on the program, but at some point I'm sure that she'll get a chance to listen into the conversation. 1-800-423-8255. I said just before we went to the break that there is this funny kind of mall phenomenon, and Laura, I caught myself as I was saying it, that you're probably much better able to talk about this from the other perspective, but somebody in the station stopped me and said, oh, my God, I had this most embarrassing experience. And I've heard that from other people, parents who find that their kids are so curious and so outspoken about seeing someone who is their height but an adult. They lose whatever, you know, political correctness might have been hammered into them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're right. I mean, it's just amazing how the conversations start. And I got to tell you, every time I go to a mall, it happens. Or no matter where I go every day, you know, kids have a general curiosity and they immediately know she's an adult. And people say, Mom, look at that little girl with a pocketbook. You know, and it's really funny what kids will say. And they say it out of, honestly, just genuine curiosity. They're not trying to be hurtful. It's their first time they've seen someone that is different to them. And some of the things kids will say is, wow, that's just crazy. Look at her. Or some kids will say, they already know the M word. And they'll say, look at her. She's a midget. Or some kids will say, are you a mother? You have a pocketbook. They get fixated on the pocketbook thing, especially if you're a woman. And I right. find that really funny. And so for me, and as Dan mentioned in his book, where Amy Roloff was talking about, you know, you got to put the face on. Here's the opportunity to educate someone and help them through the situation.
But you can't be in the mall feeling kind of crabby with a pair of sweatpants on and as any person might, and say, you know, I don't want to talk about who I am today. You're kind of public property in that way.
Mm-hmm. You do. You become that. And I find myself, I got to put myself in a place sometimes and just take a moment, because it may be a 30-second opportunity that's going to shape this person for the rest of their life. So when they see another little person or another dwarf, they're going to be able to have a positive interaction and they're going to be able to say, yep, they're just another person in society, and that's okay. So that's how I think of it. It's another opportunity. Hmm. Yeah, you know, when people follow me around the mall because they're curious, then I get annoyed. Then I think, whoa, we need to kind of like pull back people. I'm just Laura, you know. And you mentioned that, you know, especially like for me, you know, I'm, you know, a 38-year-old woman. So I'll go to the mall with a baseball hat on, sweatpants, whatever. And people say, Mom, look at the little boy with the pocketbook. So it's just amazing what kids will say and what they'll think. And it is, you have to really be up for it. But there's some people that aren't. And they have a very negative view of themselves and of what it's like to be a dwarf. So that opportunity and that discussion that child and parents can have at the moment may not always be as positive as the one I'm going to have with someone.
Dan, is this part of the Kennedy family yet?
Yeah, it is to an extent. One of the things I've experienced with Becky is walking around our town, people will slow down their cars, roll down the window and say, hi, Becky. And she'll say, hi. And I'll say, who was that? She doesn't know. And what it comes down to is almost everybody in town knows who she is, but she only knows who a few people are.
Is this a good thing or a bad thing?
It's a different thing. I don't know whether it's good or bad. One of Becky's qualities that I share with her is that she's fairly oblivious to her surroundings, and I definitely think that can be a good thing, especially since she's sort of on the cusp of adolescence where self-awareness and sensitivity over that can be so pronounced. I think the fact that she's kind of living in her own little world isn't such a bad thing at times.
And so when you try to figure out how, as a dad, you talk this through with Becky, I know you do it with the help of people like Laura, other folks that you've met at the Little People of America organization, but she says, Dad, I'm different. Do you say, well, it's a disability, or it's a genetic thing, honey, or I don't know how you kind of work some of that through. I want to hear from Laura, but I know you've written about this and thought about it, Dan, so why don't you start off on that?
Well, when Becky was younger, I'd say around 7 or 8, she was having a very hard time working through the size-age conundrum. I mean, she would tell us, she realized that she was always going to be very short. She'd say, well, I'm never going to grow up. And, you know, we have a friend, Ruth, who's fairly prominent in the book, although she's not here today. She would come over and visit, and she has an adopted son who's Becky's age, and they're good friends. And she would show Becky her car with the pedal extensions. We'd explain she owns her own home, she works. And Becky still had a hard time getting it through her head. Now that she's older, she gets it in a way that she didn't before. But you're asking about rather abstract things. her focus is very concrete. It means I can't reach things that I'd like to reach. Mm-hmm. It means if I go to the amusement park, I can't go on the really wild rides that I might like
to
go on.
She might be old
on.
Enough. She's not tall enough.
Right.
For that little height measure. Yeah.
Right, exactly. I still don't think she's really zeroed in on all of the larger picture here in terms of how this is going to affect her life. And she's probably still a little bit young for that. I mean, we're kind of taking it as it comes. We're not forcing it on her.
It's interesting, Laura, that as I'm listening to Dan talk as a father, when you use a word like grow up, I say grow up, when I did, my daughters are grown up now, but when I said grow up to them, it wasn't be taller, it was act older, act, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so we have this kind of social tangle of words that refer to people's height as a way of measuring their maturity. I meet a friend with children I haven't seen for a year or so. I say, your daughter's so big, like a compliment, you know, she's growing. And when, I mean, that's all a part of a society's language that in many ways kind of creates this curiosity. There you are in the mall, the same height as someone who's maybe, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years old, but not 5, 6, 7 years old.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, you hit the nail on the head when you talk about the word grow up. People end up kind of falling over their words, okay? It's almost the same when someone's blind, you say, I'll see you later, okay? You're right, exactly, and I've done that. But you know what? And you have to take it all in perspective. When someone says to me, when they said to me growing up, when I was a kid, oh, when you grow up, Laura, I would always say, no, when I'm older. And I would correct them. But they knew that that was just part of people talking and connecting with you. I didn't get hung up on it. But one of the things I know that, like, with my nephews, when we talk about when they get older, I don't use the word when they grow up. I'm aware of it.
Yeah.
But I'm okay when other people say it, only because if I start getting hung up on every time someone said that, you know what? I would just hang it up, and I wouldn't be able to get out of bed every day.
And I'm sorry. The point I wanted to make to sort of add on to that, we've been having a lot of talk about terminology here. The president of LPA, Matt Roloff, once told me it was reaching the point where his greatest concern was that the outside world, the average size majority, was going to become convinced that the dwarf community was so hypersensitive about everything that you wouldn't be able to talk to them. And that, you know, I mean, that's a wrong way of thinking about it, and Matt was absolutely right to be concerned about that. I mean, terminology is important, yes, but as long as you relate to each other as human beings, it really doesn't make that much difference.
And I agree with you.
1-800-423-8255. Let's take our first call from Malden, Massachusetts. John's joining us on the line. Hi, John.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a little comment. I happen to be short statured. My wife is also. And we've got a son who's almost 2 years old that's also short statured. And we've both been active in the LPA, and I'm originally from Canada and was in the Little People of Canada organization for a while.
Yeah.
But I think what we've come to realize is being short statured people, the most important thing is not to feel that it's our job to be out there kind of acting as martyrs and as you know, to try and explain to the whole world what we're all about. Being short statured is just one fact of our lives. I happen to be a high school math teacher, and you know, when I get into a classroom at the beginning of the year or if I go to a new school to teach at, the fact that I'm short statured is an obvious thing to the students, but it doesn't take them too long to just realize that that's just, you know, I wear glasses, I have dark hair, I have a beard, and it's just one other physical quality. And I think the more we kind of put it under the radar and don't pay attention to it, the easier it is for people to just realize it's just part of who we are.
So when you have one of those shopping mall encounters that Laura was talking about, John, are there times when you go, you know what, I'm a math teacher. I'm not a short person. I'm a math teacher.
Not so much that way, but I do react in what I think is a positive way. If it's a young child, you know, I do explain, hey, I'm just short. I do everything else. I drive a car. You know, I pay the bills. I earn my living, and I just get on with life. And I try to have people realize that it's nothing special. And I think one thing, a perfect example is there's a movie that just came out on DVD called The Station Agent, and it's a great movie. And the central character is a person of short stature,
right.
And the fact that he's short statured to him isn't a big deal, and he's tired of the fact that people are always, you know, making that the most obvious fact. And the most poignant part, you know, in the movie is when he goes to talk to a group of children, and he doesn't want to talk about the fact that he's short statured. He talks about something that interests him, and you know, the fact that we have interests and dislikes and likes and opinions and everything else, just like everyone else. You know, the topic of conversation shouldn't always be about how terrible and how tough life is being short-statured.
Okay, but let me return to something which pops up in Dan's book, and John, you might be able to help me with it. You're a dwarf, your wife is a dwarf, your children are also dwarves?
We have one son who's almost two, who has got achondroplasia as well.
Right, because what Dan sort of discovers as our agent here in following his own stories is the sort of puzzle about the genetic test that is available for achondroplasia. There is a possibility now for parents to have that test when a woman is pregnant and say, oh, well, you know, the kid's going to be a dwarf, and so what do we do about that? He brings in, and you sort of live this, yeah, but there's another side to the story, and that is that if I'm a mom and a dad and we're both dwarfs, maybe we want a child who's also short-statured.
Well, you do, because you like to have that great family picture where everyone looks exactly the same. But I also realize that as I grow older, I have physical limitations. I have, you know, bones are starting to hurt a little bit more than you know, someone else that's 38 years old. And things are starting to, you know, become a little more difficult. And so do you want to have your child experience those same difficulties and limitations? Part of me says, hey, I'm a man, I'm a person, it shouldn't matter what I look like or what I act like or how tall I am. But I also realize that, you know, if I could make life, quote-unquote, easier for my son, would I? You know, would I want him to grow up to be average-sized, where, you know, then people will see us as a family walking and he's a foot and a half taller than his dad? And so even that's, you know, an odder picture.
You, of course, Dan, live the other way, where your daughter is smaller than you, will always be smaller than
That's
you.
That's right, absolutely. You know, this controversy over genetic screening, you know, the gene for achondroplasia was discovered in 1994. And one of the interesting things I discovered in reading some of the medical ethics literature is that there's this great interest on the part of social scientists over the possibility that parents with dwarfism are going to selectively choose children with dwarfism. And there's this great conundrum of, if they found out that their baby would be average size, would they choose an abortion? Now, what's interesting about this is that there is absolutely no record or evidence of this ever having happened. It seems to be one of these rather sensational scenarios that medical ethicists love to talk about.
Which is not necessarily central to some conversation, say at an LPA meeting, where people are saying, you know, genetic testing. Do we need to kind of speak out as an organization about this? I don't know. Does it come up, Laura?
I mean, I think it comes up in, you know, my circle of friends that are also dwarfs, and we just talk about, you know, the fact is, you know, what are people going to do with this information? You know, how are they going to make their decision? What are they going to base it on? If somebody's going to base their decision to terminate a pregnancy just because they got a yes, no answer, I think that's wrong. I think you need to take it another step. And you need to, you know, look and see, wow, this active people that are contributing to society that are dwarfs, that have fulfilling lives, that have wonderful careers, and they're seen for their talent and not for their size. So when I hear that people may be, you know, thinking about a choice and they don't have all the facts, that's a problem. And that's not only just, you know, when you're dealing with genetic testing and you find out the child's going to be a dwarf. It's with any type of, you know, disability condition that people are going to find out about. And I think it's all about becoming informed before you make a decision, because you have to live with it for the rest of your life.
You know, one of the things I try to look at in little people is to look at dwarfism as sort of a metaphor for difference. And to think of, are we comfortable with this? Do we accept difference? Would we get rid of it if we had the opportunity? Now, today, genetic screening is not really done for dwarfism, except in the case of dwarf couples who are worried of complications with the birth.
Right.
But in a few years, it may be possible to do quick screening for hundreds of genetic conditions on a routine basis. And what some social scientists have found is that there are couples who would choose abortion not just for conditions such as dwarfism, but if they found out that their child would have a genetic predisposition toward obesity. So we kind of have this cultural myth that we're all entitled to the perfect child, and we have no idea what even the term perfect child means. I think that these are some of the issues we need to think through as we move ahead with science and technology.
Let's see if we can squeak in another call here before our next break. We're at 1-800-423-8255. And from Apex, North Carolina, Josh is on the line. Hi, Josh.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me. I was one of those children in the shopping mall about 30 years ago, and it may have been that experience that made me especially sensitive to differences and cultural differences, which led me to be an anthropologist years later. In studying anthropology in Latin America, archaeology, I was always surprised to see how the duende, the dwarf in pre-Columbian cultures, were celebrated as shamans, and they were the guardians of ceremonial places. And your guest touched on sort of this culture that we have of having the perfect child or being the perfect person. I'm wondering if any of your guests have had experiences cross-culturally with how dwarfism is treated in other cultures, and how we deal with this fact that in this culture it's something to be corrected or seen as a deficit where it might be celebrated elsewhere.
It's a great question, Josh, and I think what we're going to do is pick it up when we come back after the break. I know there's a part in Dan's book when he talks about an appearance at a Little Peoples of America conference by Native Americans who make that same kind of reference to little people as somehow very separate and distinct and imbued with magical powers. And so why don't we talk about that when we come back after the break? This is a chance for me to remind you our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My guests, Dan Kennedy, senior writer for the Boston Phoenix, author of the book Little People, Learning to See the World Through My Daughter's Eyes. And Laura Zerpolo is also with us. She's director of financial services at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to pick up right where we were before the break. Josh called in asking a question about his own experience with dwarfism in other cultures and how they see it and where that fits in an American understanding of dwarfism. Dan, it's something that you address in your book.
Yes. He mentioned pre-Columbian culture. There was also ancient Egypt where there were some deities who were depicted as dwarfs. And in fact, there was a fairly high priest named Seneb who was a dwarf. But the fact is today, it's pretty universally conceded that there is no better time or place to be different than right here, right now. The United States is well ahead of a lot of other cultures in how they treat difference. And in fact, one of the things I get into in my book is limb lengthening surgery. There's actually far more pressure to do that in some other cultures than there is in the United States.
Limb lengthening, that's making someone's leg or arm longer?
Yeah. It's a 3-year process that is done on kids when they're in their teens. And, you know, it's a fairly controversial procedure because it's painful and it's still experimental. But in fact, it gets a lot more attention in this country than there are actually people who go through it, mm-hmm. because acceptance is easier to come by in the U.S. than it is in a lot of other places.
I know that this is something that has been talked about, Laura, just in context with kids who aren't, you know, dwarves who may be, you know, 5 feet tall, and their parents go, you know, you'll be easier for you in society if you're 6 feet tall. Maybe we should talk about this. Limb lengthening, it's not a very good word for radio. Limb lengthening, is this something that's controversial?
Yeah, I would say it most definitely is. I think it because it's portrayed as a way for people to kind of remove themselves from the dwarf community, and they no longer want to be a dwarf. They want to strive to be an average-sized person. And some people have the view that they want that perfect cosmetic look and that limb lengthening is the answer. And people just see the sensationalism around that piece of it, but there's another side to it. And Dan and I have talked about this before, and he touches on it in his book, is that there's the clinical complications that go along with it. And it's all about making informed decisions. So people need to understand that before you go to this procedure, that A, is painful, B, the infection rate is high, 90%, and you spend years trying to lengthen a leg or both legs.
To get
or
what,
arms.
3 inches, 4 inches?
Oh, no, a foot or more. I spent a day with Dr. Dror Paley as he made the rounds. He may be the best limb lengthening surgeon in the world, and he really does get remarkable results. But what they do is, it's a 3-year process in which they do the upper legs, the lower legs, and the upper arms, and they will get a foot or more of height extension. And what they say is they don't really look at it as a denial of somebody's dwarf identity. It's simply to make people more functional in a human-built environment made for people who are between 5 and 6 feet tall. Now, what's interesting is talking to some of the parents and even some of the kids. These are people who have not had any involvement in the dwarf community or in Little People of America, and they are looking at dwarfism strictly in a medical context, which is that this is a problem, there's a solution, why not do it? And you know what? They're not wrong, but that's not the way we look at it, and we hope it's not the way Becky looks at it as she enters her teens and maybe starts thinking about
these
things.
But if this is something that is done in the teenage years, can you imagine yourself faced with Becky saying, "Dad, I'm 14 or I'm 16, and I'm thinking about this, are you going to say yes or no?"
It's theoretically possible. I've heard it said, and I have no reason to doubt it, that no one who's ever been involved in LPA has then turned around and had limb lengthening surgery, because you just see that it isn't worth it. You're exposed to successful, happy adults with dwarfism from a fairly early age, and you just couldn't imagine putting yourself through it. But, you know, if she were insistent about it, if she proved to be a good candidate for it, well, it's hard to imagine that we would absolutely say no.
1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join our conversation this hour as we're talking about dwarfism. And Laura, just the way that you present dwarfism and the sort of easy way that you dismiss limb lengthening, I have to think that your mother and father were pretty smart when it came to bringing you to an understanding, an acceptance that, you know, yes, you're going to be short your whole life, but it doesn't mean you're going to be short of anything your whole life. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. That was so nicely put, and that's exactly it. I mean, I had the fortunate experience of having two parents that were involved in my day-to-day life, very similar to how Dan and Barbara are approaching Becky's life. And, you know, I always had situations that came up at school, and I would come home, and we didn't really know we were doing this, but we were doing role-playing. My parents helped me deal with the situation at hand so that I could go back out the door the next day and face the playground and face those kids when they were calling me names. I mean, that's where it starts. That's where all that conditioning starts. And you need people that are dwarfs need to have a place where they can go and validate their feelings and be able to say, here's how I'm building my self-esteem, and here's how I'm building my positive attitude. And it takes years to do it. I mean, it doesn't happen overnight. And that's part of the process. My parents have really just said, Laura, guess what? You are going to be short, but that doesn't mean that you can't have a successful life and you can't contribute to society and you can't be things that you want to be. Here's the world. Have at it. And that's been my approach. And I'm always very positive about how I look at things, because if I was negative about everything, Dick, man, I wouldn't even be sitting here in the studio with you. So, and this is just a fabulous opportunity to talk about that. And I think that, you know, I wish that there were people that don't have that positive attitude that, you know, could have the luxury like I did and being fortunate to have people to encourage me, to help me validate what was going on in my life.
You've been doing this all your life. It's clear from listening to you, though, that it's a chance for you to say here in our studio some of what you also get a chance to say when you're meeting with kids at the camp or other people at the Little People of America conferences.
Exactly, exactly. You know, and it comes through in conversations with parents that are new to our group that may have a newly diagnosed child, and they're scared. And I can see it in their face. And Dan has talked with them as well. And, you know, you're thinking, you know what? It's going to be okay, and here's why. Let me show you. It's going to be tough. And I'm never, you know, I don't make a rosy picture. But I'll tell you, it's going to be tough, and you got to be up for the challenge. Just like life, just like your life. You've had challenges you've had to deal with, and you got through them.
1-800-423-8255. Next call from Hingham, Massachusetts, and Gwen's joining us. Hi, Gwen.
Hi, how are you, Dick?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Hi, Laura.
Hi, Gwen, how are you?
I'm good.
We know each other, do we?
We do.
Actually, Laura was the first dwarf adult I ever met. I have a six-year-old daughter who has achondroplasia, and she's just terrific. She's off right now at art camp, and, you know.
How's her health, Gwen?
Her health is very good. She had some early problems, not as severe as Becky did, but
right.
We did our hospital time, too. But, you know, what I wanted to say was, just as we were talking about the perfect child,
mm-hmm.
I'm fortunate in some ways, being an older parent, and I also have a teenage son who's 16. And you sort of rapidly discover that, you know, the idea of a perfect child, they're not really there. They're what a parent imagines their child will be. In fact, their child can turn out to be quite different, you know, perhaps in terms of their talents or emotionally or whatever else.
And, well, I know there's people listening to you right now nodding their heads going, yeah, you know, physically looks fine, but he's a monster.
Exactly. And you learn that as your kids get older, you know, that perhaps you wanted them to be the baseball star, but they could care less about baseball. And perhaps you can push them, but eventually they'll kick back on you or whatever. Or any of those things, the perfect student, whatever. There's a few of them around, but I don't know how they come about, to be honest.
Did you come to this, Gwen, in the last 6 years? I'm curious to know whether or not your attitude comes from the birth of your daughter and a figuring this out on your own, and whether or not in conversations that you'll have just in the neighborhood, this is something that you get an opportunity to share with other people.
Well, I think it was sort of coming about, again, having an older child.
Yeah.
You begin to realize that that's going to happen. Also, partly just thinking about my own childhood and my own parenting. I think certainly my daughter's birth cemented that knowledge. But I also wanted to add, too, that we, in fact, we weren't, they couldn't be 100% certain, but there was suggested a good likelihood when Adrian, before she was born, that in fact she would be a dwarf. And that was not from any kind of genetic screening. That was actually from ultrasound that was picked up in terms of her limb size on an actual ultrasound. That was picked up. And I know my husband and I did talk about it, that this was a possibility. That she could be born little. We did see a genetic counselor, which was very helpful. You know, they certainly don't pitch, they don't give you the rosiest picture, but the things that she did say was that cognitively my daughter would be fine, or she certainly would be within average limits, if you will.
Let me just stop you for a second, Gwen. I'm curious to know from Laura here whether or not in the years that you've been thinking about and experiencing dwarfism in America, you're sort of 30-some years ahead of Gwen's daughter. Is it going to be any easier for her?
No, I don't think so. I think it's going to be, you know, every day is going to be a new experience, and you've got to be able to handle that. And I think, I'm hoping that the gap will narrow, but, you know, I always have to be a realist, too. You've got to be able to instill these skills, you know, in people that have a difference, to be able to manage their life and be able to deal with their difference on a day-to-day basis.
I want to read just a paragraph from the conclusion of Dan Kennedy's book, with your permission, Dan. He writes, Becky's heading into what may be the most difficult and painful part of her life, adolescence, when easygoing childhood gives way to the all-consuming need to fit in. Already her blissful obliviousness is giving way to self-consciousness, to embarrassment over those moments when her difference suddenly becomes blindingly obvious, not just to her, but to those around her. Give me an example of what you see now with a girl who's close to her 12th birthday.
Just a small example of something that really was kind of a surprise to me. From the time Becky started going to school, she had this special chair that my wife had arranged for the school system to get. And it was this contraption that allowed her to sit at her desk and have her feet on a footrest and be up at the same level as everybody else. And it never seemed to bother her a bit. Well, I was talking with her one day, and she told me that she'd gotten rid of the chair and had substituted a stool. And I said, well, why did you do that? And she said, well, I wanted to be just like everybody else. And so I did that, and I thought it was brilliant. And I said, well, you know what? It is. But it sort of showed a dawning self-consciousness that had never been there before. And I think that's really just the beginning.
So, Laura, what's the advice for Becky? Making it through adolescence, is that like the biggest hurdle? Is high school going to be just as tough for her? What do you say?
I say, you know what? You just take it each day that, you know, life brings you, and that you have an opportunity to sit down and talk with your parents when things happen, and you talk with your other friends in LPA, or you know, you talk about it, because if you keep that stuff inside, you know, and you don't get a chance to verbalize it and get it out there, then you're just going to be bottling it up, and you're going to be one big volcano going to explode, because every day of your life, you're constantly reminded that you're different, no matter whether you're on the train going to work or you're going to school in the playground. So it's, you know, adolescence is tough, but then so is when you're in your early 20s, when you're dating and you want to find the mate, and then you know, you want to get married, and you got to find the job, and you want a career, you're going to college, and then you're in your 30s, and you're ready to settle down, and you want to have a family. I mean, every stage of your life is a challenge, so I think that, you know, adolescence is going to bring a whole new set of challenges for Dan. But Dan, you know what? You show up. You're there. So you're like 95% there. You're gonna go along for the ride. So I think that's half it. You gotta show up, be there, and you are. So you gotta give yourself credit, you and your wife, for that. And I'll tell you, that's a success right there. You may not know it yet, but I know it. I can feel it. I can see it.
If you'd like to know more about Becky Kennedy, Dan and Barbara, the name of the book's Little People: Learning to See the World Through My Daughter's Eyes. Written by Dan Kennedy. Dan, so good of you to come in. Thanks for being part of the program.
Thank you, Dick.
Dan Kennedy is also senior writer for the Boston Phoenix. Laura Zerpolo, it was great to have you here. Thanks so much for coming in.
It's fabulous. Thank you.
Laura is director of financial services at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts. Now, you can find links to Little People of America, to Dan Kennedy's website, and also our own gallery of photos, which we've snitched with Dan's permission from his book. It's all at our website. We are at www.theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.